The plasma wave. And the plasma wave are made by electromagnetic waves. And Dr. Roy, question. Is that case of electromagnetic wave longitudinal or it is transversal?
As far as I'm aware, electromagnetic waves are transverse waves. Now, you might be able to confuse the issue. This occurs in free space. You might confuse the issue by some kind of interesting waveguide or such, in which there's a lot of bouncing around and shifting, and electromagnetism is the mass that makes up the wave equations can be defined all kinds of interesting ways, and one of them is your favorite longitudinal method. But again, my gut feeling of electromagnetism, certainly in free space, is it is a transverse wave phenomenon.
I love it. Wikipedia. Plasma waves are longitudinal since those are not electromagnetic waves but density waves or charged particle waves but which can couple to the electromagnetic field. After Hevesy attempts to generalize Maxwell's equation, Hevesy concluded that electromagnetic waves were not to be found as longitudinal waves in free space or homogeneous media. And then another from waves in plasmas from Wikipedia. An electromagnetic wave, in contrast, must have transverse component, but may also be partially longitudinal. Waves can be further classified by oscillating species. In most plasmas of interest, the electron temperature is comparable to or larger to the ion temperature. So we may conclude that plasma waves are longitudinal waves with transverse components. And there are scientific additions that with numbers that you could read from it. So it should be noted that those plasma waves are longitudinal waves. In example, the displacement of electrons relative to the uniform positor, positive background form by positive ion are parallel to the direction of propagation of the wave. Those plasma waves can exist in two-dimensional space, although the dispersion of the wave is different from the three-dimensional plasma. So when we were talking about the plasma, I was talking about laser beam between two mirrors, and we place in between a thin plate of a germanium or any other similar object, we creating tri-dimensional plasma, polaritrons. Now, when plasmons are excited in the plasma, one creates resonances. So the important thing to note is now that plasmas are longitudinal waves, so they cannot not be excited by transverse waves like electromagnetic waves. However, things are a little bit different in a two-dimensional waveguide, which is called the interface. University of California, Berkeley. Peter U. Y. And that was his comment. And to Xia.
Got somebody trying to come in from Echo Link.
Yeah, Wesley, let's be quiet for a couple of seconds. Frank, WB2BXO, I think, has something to say on the subject.
Some silence on the repeater, and I thought you guys should drop that. This is a subject I know a heck of a lot about. I'll try to chime in when you guys get to the space section.
Okay, Frank, getting back to Wesley, you kind of switch and bait. You asked if photons are transverse or linear, and I said they're transverse. And then you started to talk about plasmons. Plasmons are not photons. They're quasi-particles. They're sort of like electrons. They're sort of like photons. They're different things. You can create plasmons either with photons or charged particles, but they are neither. So one does not equal the other. So you asked me a question about one thing, and you described another thing.
I went from finding the difference between surface and plasmon polaritron, which is two things at once, and the surface plasmon resonance. And at resonance, we have interesting things that are happening there. What I'm saying is that when we're dealing with surface plasmon polaritron, which is two things at once, and we establish that plasmon, that polaritron, is half matter and half photon. Now that is said in the literature, but it's also said in that video that I had sent you. I said, I specified that 20 seconds, what 20 seconds. And there is a graph between 2 mirrors. So now, let me drop. We came to that with the final case, which will be the confusion about electromagnetic wave, and that at this particular case, at longitudinal, or the longitudinal wave with a traveling, with a transverse wave component. Do you agree with that?
I don't exactly know what we're trying to get at here. One of the things that I would caution you, and again, I could be wrong, what the hell do I know? When you say that plasmons are half photons and half electrons, I think that's kind of a slippery kind of description you picked up from someplace that goes sort of back to a very similar version of wave-particle duality, where they say that the electrons and photons are waves and particles. But the deeper understanding appears to be that they are neither waves nor particles, but something that acts like each of these things under certain circumstances. Understanding and the mathematical rigor to better explain what these objects truly are, neither particle nor wave in origin. I think that's the same thing with quasi-particles. There's something that our mathematics and brains can't fully wrap our heads around. So the short term is the less accurate concept that it's part electron and part photon. But I don't think that's really the case. I think that's just kind of a placeholder for a much more deeper understanding of what's actually going on there.
Mr. Roy, I never said that plasmons are half matter, half photons. I said polaritrons. And polaritrons exist in three-dimensional space. It is important to understand what are the plasmons. As I pointed out, plasmons are oscillations of the electrons in plasma. Such oscillations are traveling waves with well-defined frequency and wave vector. And actually,
okay, but they're still kind of termed as quasi-particles, and that kind of means that no one really quite knows. It's, again, there's a lot of things that are placeholders, and people usually don't worry about it because it doesn't really affect them. You know, when people discuss the spin of an electron, they tend to either don't think about it or they think of it in terms of orbital mechanics, that the electron is sitting there, it has a particular radius, it's spinning on its axis, and that's not what's going on. physics sort of borrows concepts that somewhat are similar to, but not the, really the same thing. And I think that's what's going on with polaritons as well.
I believe the most confusion comes from the point that some people have a problem to understand what are the plasma waves. Plasma waves are longitudinal. Since they are not electromagnetic waves, but density waves of charged particles. Because they have a charged particles, they can couple to the electromagnetic field. And that's the problem. But the reason I touched that is because I want to go a little bit further. So what I pointed in here at first is a traditional understanding of electromagnetic wave as transversal wave is not at this case. At this case, we're dealing with something that could be understood in the simple words, which is not the exact explanation for it, as half of longitudinal wave and half of a transverse wave, or rather a longitudinal wave that can couple to the transversal wave. So it would be rather in a matter of coupling, not a matter of the character of it. Dr. Roy.
Time for Paul.
Yes, actually it is time for Paul, so I'm going to need you to wrap it up in a few minutes. It's certainly possible to have longitudinal waves that interact with transverse waves. You can send a volley of charged electrons in the vacuum of space, and it's a longitudinal phenomena, but it couples with electromagnetism. So it certainly is possible for that, less esoteric experiments, and possible for more esoteric. So unfortunately, we're coming up to 10:17, so if you can kind of wrap this up in a bow, Wesley.
Unfortunately, I have a few more things that would be interesting. A surface wave is used in radar, but it's used also in communication. And there are a few types of surface wave, but actually we may imagine that we're dealing with the Earth and we're dealing with the air above the Earth, and then that the interface between air as a dielectric and Earth as a loosely conducting medium is that two-dimensional interface. And what is believed because of power used by Marconi, who established communication between England and Canada, and that was the first time that there was such a communication, that we're using actually a interface, not knowing that they do that. Because if you have that wave, standing wave at a browser angle that is going into the interface without the losses, then we have all energy in the interface. And it is a matter of us later on at the free time to trying to convince each other whether this inverse square law applies completely or apply partially, or just works differently in the two-dimensional space. When the electric component is at 90 degrees to the magnetic one, and the magnetic one now has the priority in it, in transverse magnetic mode. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome, Wesley. I am AC2GS, and this is the Limar Technical Net, and I just want to remind everyone, if you have any questions for the Technical Net, or if you have any topics you would like to hear covered, or if you have a puzzle to offer me so that I could share it with the rest of the people listening, or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at the space report, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links will be available on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, Mike KC2NJI has a wonderful archive of technical nets that is, go back as far as September 2006. So please keep that in mind, and sometime during the week, check it out, listen to a couple of them. You know, listening to Dick K2RIW and Mel K2KEY and John KC2WGB and all the great guys, Eric, I could go on and on. So please avail yourself of that. And now it is time for the SpaceNet report. Call WS2N.
AC2GS WS2N. Very good. Listen to the whole net. And very interesting. Now, there's a few things that are new for the end of the year. Usually you get to the end of the year around this time, around the holidays. For some reason, things slow down in the space world. You know, they're always working on stuff, but the launches tend to slow down. But SpaceX is going full blast. I mean, they're launching one rocket after the other, and they're also into testing their new spaceship called Starship. Anybody that's listened to this net or follows the news on this topic, the Starship is the one that SpaceX, Elon Musk, is building to eventually go to Mars. NASA's even thinking that they could use the Starship to go to the moon as well. But his main goal is to occupy Mars, send literally hundreds of these things to Mars. That's Elon Musk. The Falcon 9 has been very successful. We started off with the Falcon 1, and he got up to the fourth mission, the fourth test flight on Falcon 1. And if that one failed, like 1, 2, and 3, he was going to go out of business in early 2000s. But it made it to orbit, and NASA gave him a $1.5 billion contract to become a commercial contractor for NASA. And he's been off to the races ever since. And he was going to develop the Falcon 5, but skipped that, just went right to the Falcon 9 after that. So now he's been developing he succeeded in the Falcon 9. He's actually launched over 100 Falcon 9s now. But he's been developing this new rocket called the Starship. Falcon 9 has 9 engines, and each engine is called the Merlin engine. And each Merlin engine has a little over 200,000 pounds of thrust. And these new engines he has for the new Starship, they're called Raptor engines. And it has over twice the amount of power of each of the old Falcon engines, the Merlin engines. So the Raptor engines, very much, each one's over 400,000 pounds of thrust. So he's tested them many times. He's actually lifted a vehicle off the ground over the last few months with one engine. It just blew up around 500 feet, went over and landed right nearby. He wanted to make sure he had control over this thing. But since that time, he's been developing it. He put a nose cone on top of it, and now he's got these flaps on the front and on the back part of the spacecraft. It really looks like something out of Flash Gordon or something from the 1950s. It's very wide. It's around 30 feet in diameter, and it's around 160 feet tall. Like a 15-story building. And essentially this Starship is really the second stage of what will be eventually a bigger rocket. The booster, they call it the Heavy, Starship Heavy. That is under construction as well. But for now, he wants to be able to at least get this thing developed where it could take off and come back and land. And he put this one through the first test. It's called SN8, or the serial number 8. I call it Starship number 8. Because he's built different ones, and he's blown some up on purpose. He's blown some up accidentally on a pad by overpressurizing the tanks and that type of thing. And he learns as he goes. So this one he was able to launch last Wednesday. He put, instead of one Raptor engine, he put three Raptor engines in it. So it's equivalent to almost the same amount of power that he would normally launch a Falcon 9 with. Falcon 9 would launch with around 2.7 million pounds of thrust. This was just over 2 million pounds of thrust. And he has this, again, 30-foot diameter rocket, 160 feet tall, with these two flaps on it. These are flaps on the front and flaps on the back. And his goal was to launch it roughly as high as an airplane, a little higher than an airplane would fly. So instead of, like, you know, 7 miles high, he wanted to go up to around 8 or 9 miles high, which apparently he did. He successfully launched the vehicle. I watched this thing live on the SpaceX website. It's called the webcast. So it was really something to watch this thing take off. It took off very slowly. Rose out of the smoke. And this is down in Texas, by the way. He's launching this. That's his location for all these starships that he's building. So with that, he's got these three engines going, and you got a view of the rocket from a distance taking off, and then you also have a view of the three engines. You know, he's got a camera inside the engine bay, so you can see these three engines. And you can see them moving around. They're gimbling. You know, gimbling is where you can move each engine individually, different angles. And you see all the three engines working, thing taking off, and you're looking at the other view at the same time. And he gets up to around 2 minutes into flight, and he's got a time where one engine shuts down, and the gimbling works such that the other two engines are still firing. They centerize themselves, and the other one moves out of the way. And he flies for another minute, and he's still going higher and higher. And you can see that because he's also got a view looking straight down at the coast of Texas, so you can see the Gulf of Mexico. And he's flying higher with the two engines, and sure enough, the other engine shuts down. Now he's only flying on the one engine. When I say only, he's still pushing over 400,000 pounds of thrust, which is a lot. He's able to, it was rising, and you can see it was slowing down to the point where it's almost stopped, and he shuts that last engine off. Now all engines are off, and you can see the thing starting to go to the side, and his goal was to make this thing, he calls it a belly flop, come down, instead of vertically, he's going to come down horizontally, fall through the air, and he wants to see if this re-entry type of system will work, especially eventually from orbit. So it's dropping and naturally picking up speed, but as he gets down closer to the ground, he reignites the three engines. And sure enough, the rear of the engines, he gimbals them. And plus, he's got some nitrogen control jets on the vehicle itself. So that helps him straighten himself out. And sure enough, the back end comes down. So now it's standing up vertical. And its goal was to land on a pad, again, in Boca Chica, Texas, where he took off from. And he's right above the pad. There's a square pad that he's got built there. And he came down dead center of it. So it looked good, but he came down a little too fast, and he hit that, and the whole thing just blew up at the end. He's very happy with it. He sent the message to the team that he's very happy with the results. He got around 95% of the data back. Everything was successful. In other words, launching, engine shutting down. One at a time, the vehicle tilting over, and then these flaps, it's called wings, but these flaps they're controlled, they're moved by electric motors, bigger mass of electric motors with Tesla batteries, of course Tesla because he owns the Tesla cars, Tesla batteries operating these wings and controlling the re-entry. able to guide itself all the way back. You could, you know, you could see by watching this on the screen, he was way up there, you know. You could tell he was higher than a plane when you look back down at the coastline. And he's able to come all the way down, pinpointed it right to the landing spot. And later on, a couple days later, I read that he didn't have enough pressure in the in one of the tanks to pressurize the rocket. Wasn't getting enough fuel to the engine, so he lost a little thrust at the end. Now, to do this, he's got this regular. The whole thing is really but nothing but one big tank, an oxygen, liquid oxygen tank and liquid methane tank. And that's what gets him up, but then all the way up to where he's got to go. But when he comes back down and he reignites the engines, he's using another tank entirely plus an oxygen tank. The oxygen tank is located way in the nose, so he calls it the header tank. But not only does he have to, he's got to mechanically switch over to the different fuel lines. When the fuel is exhausted going up, he's got to be able to shut them down and then reopen these other valves to allow the other fuel to supply the engines, you know, for landing. But he's very happy. He thought maybe this thing would blow up going up. He's built multiple Starships, got them all lined up in Boca Chica at, you know, different points of construction. So he's got SN9, serial number 9, ready to come out to take SN8's place. And I'm sure his goal is now to try to figure out a way to, you know, get more pressure in and straighten out the landing. I mean, that's the goal. The ultimate goal is eventually to add three more engines. So you now, instead of three engines, you got six engines on this thing, and those six engines will eventually take them to orbit, and then eventually come back and land. I mean, that will not be the normal way to do it, but you would like to be able to do that with this basically is the second stage. When the first stage is built, and it's in the process of being built now, in that same location, eventually the first stage will do the same thing. It will launch, like a regular standard rocket. The second stage will eventually separate from the first stage. The second stage will go into orbit. This way, you know, the second stage will have plenty of fuel, and, you know, when it goes into orbit to maybe go to the moon or something. But the first stage will come back as well and land back where it started from. But that'll be the super heavy booster, as he calls it. And that will all be reusable. So, you know, for the first time, you'll have a complete reusable rocket. The Falcon 9 is almost reusable, the second stage on a Falcon 9. Re-enters the atmosphere and it's destroyed. So that's the story on Starship, the development of that. I've been keeping up with this, you know, as it's been developed for I don't know how many years now. And he's to the point where I think next time around he's probably going to make it. He'll probably land it and eventually reuse SN9 and probably test it multiple times for reuse. Any questions for this topic? This is Paul again. My call is WS2N. Anyway, it's an interesting onto the computer. Usually the webcast that he has the latest flight, and since they just launched another rocket, you know, recently, you won't be able to see that one, but it, you can put in SpaceX SN8, serial number 8, SN8 Starship flight, and you can watch watch the light on, I guess, one of the YouTubes that are out there. But, you know, instead of the commercial YouTubes, you better off going to the SpaceX website and going through them. You don't get any commercials, and you get to see the whole thing, and they have much better pictures than the commercial YouTube guys. They have guys that are down there that watch these things. It's called Lab Padre is the most popular one. And they have, you know, guys have comments and, talking about it. But as far as I'm concerned, the best pictures you're going to get are from SpaceX when it comes to any of these launches that he does do, whether it's Falcon 9 or now the Starship. So, okay, let me continue on. Drop it.
Paul?
Go ahead. I heard Paul.
Yeah, Paul, I just wanted to point out to Franken on Echolink, WB2BXO. I think he wanted to say something, and he got through to Echolink, and then you started your transmission. So maybe if you pause a little bit longer, he'll be able to either ask a question or make a comment.
Okay, let's wait for Frank. Sorry about that, Frank. I know you're out there. I'm going to unkey.
Yeah, okay, no problem. I wasn't sure if you were done and ready for the next question. You're going to watch this thing blow up. And in this afternoon at lunchtime when I put on the Falcon 9, the Sirius XM satellite launch, planning asked me, is this one going to blow up or is this one really going to go somewhere? I said, no, this is a real satellite for a real customer and they will be very upset if this one blows up. I'll try to chime in. Go ahead.
Hey, Frank. Yeah, I watched it multiple times, so eventually I put it on my big TV. So it's pretty incredible. You watch the YouTube guys, you know, and one guy put it out. There must have been a lot of people where he was standing, where he was making it, you know, where he made the video. And it was very strange that, you know, you could hear the people say, ooh, ah, you know, as it's going up and as it's coming down. But when it blew up, people were cheering. I didn't get that. I mean, I don't know why anybody would cheer for that. But I thought that was strange. But the SpaceX one, if you bought that one up, right, you're probably really going to kick out of it. You might comment if that was the one where you could see the engines moving. You know, they had a camera inside the engine part. So, yeah, okay. I was going to move on to another topic, but I'd rather do questions. Back to you, Frank. This is WS2F.
Yeah, Paul, very good. I feel like I'm on HF and have good propagation for a change. That's a whole other thing. 10 meters was disappointing in the 10-meter contest because of solar storm, but that's a whole other topic. Anyway, yeah, I was wondering, last week, John Michael Gauthier's Event Horizon show on YouTube talked about apparently the latest theory on the WOW signal, something we used to talk about quite a bit on this net. And what you thought of the latest theory, which is apparently it seems that it may have come from a sun-like star that is in the data in the direction it came from, but nobody's ever paid attention to it. It's not in the catalogs, so it's there in the data. And apparently, the guy that Gauthier interviewed has a degree in intelligence analysis and theorizes that the signal was a radar pulse from a planet in that star system that so far hasn't been cataloged. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, okay. Yeah, I did see an article about that recently. But yeah, Dick used to love, you know, K2RIW used to love the WOW signal topic. I think it was 1977. And there was a guy that, when they saw that, they put a, you know, they had charts, you know, the charts would come out. They weren't like today with, you know, computer screens. It was an actual chart, you know, printout. And the guy actually circled the area where, you know, on the printout and then wrote the word WOW on it. And apparently the signal was so strong and it was, seemed to be, they said it's definitely not from washing machines, it's definitely not from other satellites. And that's why it confused me when this guy thinks it might be from some kind of radar. I thought they eliminated all of that. And then for years nobody had a good reason of what it was, you know, what it was. And by the way, it was not repeatable. This didn't show up like a year later or 3 years later or a month. They need something to be repeatable. But it stood out, you know, and blew the noise away. One theory, Carl Sagan had one, that maybe it was a comet and passing some kind of an area in space where maybe there was distortion in space creating a magnifying effect that might have temporarily, you know, raised the signal from a comet going by or something like that. That's what I've always heard of. But now this new guy's got some other theory. But it doesn't look like it's conclusive. Is that right? They didn't say that this was definitely it. Is that true, Frank?
No, nothing's conclusive on this. I think what he implied in the interview was that the signal could have been a radar pulse from a radar on a planet in that star system, not a radar pulse from Earth, you know, and that maybe, you know, it wasn't a communication signal. And nothing's definitive. I don't know that anybody's ever going to come up with anything definitive. Another theory I heard recently as well is a hydrogen cloud off in that direction, and the signal was slightly off the hydrogen line, and it could have been a redshifted signal, hydrogen line from that cloud. Though, of course, the signal strength, I forget what the strength was, makes that kind of mysterious. Yeah. Mel and Dick used to like to talk about it, and well, I'm not sure if I ever saw it. Mel said he was a technician on the Big Ear, and that he actually had a copy of the, I'm not sure whether he had a copy or the original paper chat recording of it. So yeah, these guys love to talk about it and speculate about it, you're right.
Yeah, the Big Ear. They eventually disassembled that thing, I believe. But and it was soon after they assembled it when they did put it together that they got that signal. You know, everybody's hoping for hearing ET. Okay, so this guy thinks it's from a radar from another world. Well, sounds like that would have been repeatable. I don't know. That's the biggest problem. They've had many, events like this over the decades, but none of them seem to be repeatable. The original ones, pulsars, you know, they would get pulsars, and at the time, I don't think they knew what a pulsar was. Oh, listen to this. There's a beacon out there. Meanwhile, there's a star spinning around. So, very good. And you can see that chart in one of Carl Sagan's books, yes. He shows a picture of the chart that's circled with the name WOW on it. One of the books, I have it here. I forget which book. Okay, very good, Frank. Let me just go on to one other topic at least. This WS2, unless you have another comment, Frank, I'll keep.
Yeah, the only other thing I came across this week that's kind of mildly interesting was apparently some retired Israeli intelligence chief is claiming he has evidence of extraterrestrial civilizations, but I kind of suspect that the guy's a bit of a crackpot. I haven't really heard any details on that, so I wonder if you heard that one. I doubt it's credible, though. Go ahead with your next one, the B2BX, though.
Yes, I did hear that. Yeah, something that came out of Israel. And, yeah, somebody came up with that. Like you, that kind of like went in one ear right out of the other. You know, you need extraordinary proof when you're going to make an extraordinary claim. Again, Carl Sagan, he's like to preach that in different words, but I'm a big fan of that. You know. Well, release the information, and then we'll investigate it, and years from now, we'll figure out whether or not it was true. Okay, yeah, I just wanted to say that NASA has chosen 18 astronauts from their astronaut corps, which they have more than 18, but they took 18 that's... the Apollo program, they call this one the Artemis program. And this is their goal of eventually sending people back to the moon. So they've picked 18 astronauts that, you know, I have listed here. I'm not going to go through them, but I can tell you, I recognize quite a few of them, and I would say about over half at least, if not more, have their ham radio license. Some of them have flown before. In fact, two of them, Kate Rubin and Victor Grover, they're up there right now on the International Space Station. And they're two of the 18. And they have their ham license. Kate's been up a couple of times. Second trip to the International Space Station. Well, these people are someday... the Trump administration would have loved it to do. They were pushing for that, but they never got any extra money for that they would need. They would need around $4 billion extra per year. They have, you know, they didn't get 10 cents. Well, they got some money, but they didn't get what they would need to accomplish this. The original goal was 2028. I'm sticking with that, and I think it's going to switch back to 2028 within about 38 days. Let me drop this. But, they haven't given up on doing this. There's two ways of landing somebody on the moon. One is the direct land, you know, landing similar to what they did with Apollo. You launch a crew vehicle. With a lander and a ascent module, and eventually an ascent module docks the crew vehicle, the Orion spacecraft, and you come back to Earth, similar to what they did with Apollo. They have this other plan that they've been working on called the Gateway Space Station. Gateway Space Station will be in this halo orbit around the moon, in a very large elliptical orbit, you know, going out to like 40,000 miles away
not quite that far, but around 30,000 miles away from the moon, and coming closer, around 1,000 miles, between apogee and perigee. And they plan on leaving the space station there, you know, permanently, and crewed most of the time, you know, when, especially if there's flights going to and from the moon. So you have a crew on board the space station, Gateway, and then you'll have eventually crew coming from Earth with the space station, getting ready to go down to the moon. They're going to have this transition vehicle that Grumman is building, which will, you know, essentially is a big booster that will be able to go from this higher orbit where the Gateway station is to eventually a low orbit, you know, 60 miles above the surface of the moon. That transition vehicle will stay there in orbit, and the whole crew will go down on a lander being built by Blue Origin, which is essentially Jeff Bezos, the same guy that owns Amazon. And they'll land on the moon, and then eventually they'll take off with another ascent vehicle built by Lockheed. You got all these different companies involved. Northrop Grumman with the transition vehicle. You got Blue Origin with the landing vehicle, and you got Lockheed with the ascent vehicle. And it's a mishmash of everybody. I guess everybody has to have a piece of the action. But hopefully this gets accomplished before the turn of the next decade. But I'm going to guess around 2028. And then you'll see some of these 18 people that have been chosen to either go to Gateway or go to the moon or both. Or, you know, they're going to train and work with the Artemis program, which essentially is to get to the moon, you take the Orion spacecraft, which is like pretty much built right now. It's like 90% built. So that should be interesting. And I remember not too long ago, a month or so ago, we talked about the possibility of, you know, getting a QSL card from the moon. Well, with all these astronauts that have been chosen, I guess that possibility isn't too far-fetched now. Somebody someday, either on a Gateway space station or maybe from the surface of the moon, will be able to transmit. That we have now, but it's doable, and maybe someday it will be commonplace to get your QSL card from the moon. This is WS2N. Any questions, comments?
Yeah, for whatever it's worth, Paul, I think the ARRL has already said it's not, they don't want to count the moon and Mars bases in CXTC countries. But I suspect that's going to change in future years, but maybe long after we are going to care about it. But it'd be 2BXO again.
Very good. That'd be hard to get. I always try to get Antarctica. You know, I look through that DX list, and I would say, you know, at least 3-4 months out of the year, you'll see somebody transmitting from Antarctica. You know, and one of the bands. And, I've tried them. I've actually heard them, but I've never contacted them. That would be cool. But I could imagine the moon. You know, that's way out there. And to get QSL cards from all the states is always fun. Try to get all 50 states. For some reason, I can't get Alabama. It's like people in Alabama don't believe in sending QSL cards out or something. I got a lot of contact from Alabama, but I can't get a card there. So somebody here, move down to Alabama, get on the air and send me a card. Any comments or questions? WS2.
I know I'm going to get in trouble. You don't speak the language from Alabama. Stacy wanting to say some sexy people.
Very good. I can shoot as good as they can, I guess. I don't know. It's just one of those things. I got through all 49, you know. And what are you going to do? What are you going to do, Sam? But I got contact with them, you know, on CW's 5-band. Just can't. I've even said, you know, send me a card. I sent them cards. It's not going to happen. That's okay. Let's see. Actually, you know, now that you bring it up, I should get on that, the digital modes. Maybe that would work. You know, I hear people getting, going through all 50 states in no time. You know, in no time. What are you going to do? All right, the other statement I was going to make, if we get any later, was about the Boeing Starliner that's being built. It's a Starship, now this is the Starliner being built by Boeing. Will eventually be a crewed vehicle. Starliner will eventually have 4 people. That's the goal, just like the Dragon vehicle right now by SpaceX to fly them to the space station.
That's time complete.
And resupply the vehicle with the crew. So you have 2 companies doing it. And, there was competition, you know, friendly competition between the 2 companies, between Boeing and SpaceX on who was going to do it first. And SpaceX, of course, won out. They sent up 2 people last May. And they were both hams, Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley. And then they eventually sent the other 4 up there recently, and that they are up there right now. So now you have a total of 7 people on board the space station. And they went up with a Dragon crew vehicle. Well, this one's the Starliner being built by Boeing. You know, they had sent one up. The idea is you have to send one up without a crew. Connect to the International Space Station and then bring it back down all autonomously. SpaceX had done that first with their Dragon crew vehicle, and eventually they sent the crew of 2 and then crew of 4. Boeing tried to do that with Starliner last December. It didn't work out. They sent it up and was on the way to connect to the space station, but things went wrong. They had computer problems, a mismatch between the computer on board the vehicle and the ground crew. You know, it was off by a certain period of time. The Starliner, when it got to space, didn't know where it was, or it should, you know, according to the computer, it was, you know, further down the line, and it was trying to fire its rockets, using up all its fuel, trying to get back to where it was supposed to be. And before you know it, it started to run low on fuel. NASA knew what was going wrong, and they eventually were able to shut it down. Mission Control in Houston, so they eventually had enough fuel to deorbit it, bring it back, and land. It doesn't land in the water like the Dragon does. The Dragon flies back and lands in the Atlantic Ocean on the first mission with the crew. Up 2 landed in the Gulf of Mexico. The water was kind of rough and bad weather for the Atlantic, but that one lands in the water. This one here lands on land, comes down, you know, deorbits from orbit, you know, with the retro rockets, got a heat shield, comes through the atmosphere, parachutes open up on Starliner, and in this case, it lands in White Sands, New Mexico. Down to lower the ground, it's got these 6 big airbags that, you know, instantly inflate right before they hit. And that's what it hits. And then the airbags actually have, you know, openings, valve openings, where when it does hit, you know, it's not like hitting a solid balloon. Right away, the air gets pushed out it hits the ground this way, you know, it acts like a very soft cushion for the crew that's on board. And that's how this thing is going to be coming back. And that all worked, so, you know, they tested a lot of the components of Starliner. And everything worked. It launched properly on an Atlas V rocket, which is also built by Boeing and Lockheed together on a ULA rocket, United Launch Alliance Atlas V, with two solid boosters that were attached to it. So that worked good. But it just didn't make it to the space station. So now they're going to fly this duplicate of what they did. They fixed everything up through. There was 83 different things that they saw that were wrong that Boeing fixed. Now they're going to try again this March, I think the end of March, which should be interesting. And if that all goes well, they expect the crew to be sent up a few months after that. And their first crew will have three people on board. Eventually, they will have a permanent crew of four, just like SpaceX does now. And this increases the amount of science that we get off the International Space Station. The standard crew for quite a few years now has been the crew of six, and now you're going to have a standard crew of seven. That one extra person, they say, it doubles the amount of science that you get back from the International Space Station. A lot of the time is spent by the crew maintaining the space station, so you have to only put a certain amount of hours into science. But by putting this extra person up there, they were getting around 35, 40 hours of science back, and that's going to double that amount. So that should be good. Any questions or comments? I'm looking at the time, so I'm going to come to a grinding halt here. Any comments or questions? This is WS2X.
Yes, Paul, just wondering if you're on ARRL's logbook of the world, and you don't need the QSL card. I'm two bands short of 5BMDXCC doing it that way. WB2BX.
No, I'm not. I still have QSL cards here. And I always hope I get, stuff through the mail. But, I remember when that came out. It was a big thing. Got a lot of articles in QST about it. But I never did sign up for that. It looked like they wanted your, too much information at the time. And those days, it was pretty much, I remember reading a lot of articles, don't give out too much information. And they wanted, everything. But now it doesn't matter. Now you have your FRS numbers and all these things that we have. So maybe I should do it. So, things have changed. Any other questions or comments? Okay, I guess not. And I can see the Selden repeater is doing very good out here. In fact, the other one is doing good, too, in Glen Oaks. It's a little crappy at the beginning of the net, but then now all things will go away. So, okay. Tomorrow's ClubNet, ClubInfoNet. Be on that. Hopefully. That always comes on at 8:30 on these repeaters. Both repeaters are doing very good. So I'm going to turn it over to Roy, AC2GS, WS2N. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you very much, Paul, for the SpaceNet report and everything that you do. And thanks to everyone who participated tonight. As I often say, participants make or break a technical net. You don't want to hear me just babbling away to myself, so I thank every single person who participated tonight. And as always, want to remind people before we leave that if you have any questions and you can't get to them on the radio, or topics you'd like to hear discussed, or puzzles you'd like to share, or you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at some space-related news, the email address to get in touch with me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links of pertinent articles are available on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. and always want to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive of the technical net going as far back as September of 2006, so please avail yourself of that. That's at amateurradio.tv. And